You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations, rather than boasts.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. My studio guest today is Dr. Annie Gray. She'll be talking to us about her book, The Greedy Queen, Eating with Victoria, about the diet of Queen Victoria. We'll also hear from Anne-Marie Young, who's co-authored a book with Michael Rosen aimed at young adults, answering questions about refugees and migrants. And we'll hear more winners and runners-up from the Rock Road Library writing competition. But first of all, Annie, thank you very much for being here. Lovely to have you. Just thinking, we're going to hear fictional contributions from the entrants for the Rock Road Library Writing Competition. Just got me thinking about fictional representations of Queen Victoria. There have been quite a few over the years. Jenna Coleman, Anna Neagle, Judy Dench, Emily Blunt, I think.
Yes. Many of them slightly prettier than the Queen was, it must be said. Both Jenna Coleman and Emily Blunt, rather gorgeous. Whereas Queen Victoria wasn't much of a looker, although everybody complimented her on her very fine complexion. I think the sort of fictional depictions of Victoria really do fall into one of two camps, and they represent the two ideals of Queen Victoria that most people have in their mind. There's the young, slender queen, quite a new fictional depiction, it must be said, who was very lovely, very vivacious, who got married, who fell in love, all of those kind of romantic ideals. And then there's the older, the Black Widow of Windsor. And that's the one, that latter one is really the one I think tends to be most in people's imaginations, all the way from Judy Dench through to actually Queen Victoria and Horrible Histories as well. The only exception I can think of is a question I keep getting asked at the moment at book talks, which is about whether or not Queen Victoria used to eat pandas, which threw me completely the first time I heard it.
Please tell me she didn't.
No, she didn't. I think it comes from a cartoon at the moment that's doing the rounds on CBeebies or CBBC or one of the children's channels, where she travels the world with Darwin looking for exotic things to eat, and they're a member of an exotic dinner club, which she wasn't. On the other hand, I think it's fairly safe to say that if she found a creature she hadn't eaten before, she probably would have tried it. So in some ways, I think that, although it's totally fictional and totally bonkers, is closer to the Queen as I ended up thinking of her after writing the book than any of the others.
I suppose it's natural that people are drawn to her as a figure, isn't it? We feel we know something about her, but not an awful lot. She's quite a mysterious figure in many ways.
She is, and she's also utterly iconic. Britain's always struggled with queens. The very fact that we have them is quite at odds with most of Europe. But our queens have always been something that we've sort of had a few problems with. I mean, Elizabeth managed to be queen by declaring that she would be queen and embody the state and she wouldn't marry. And then we managed Mary II, who was married, so you can safely ignore her because she had a safe husband who was also in line to the throne, so you can dwell on him. And Anne, you know, Anne nobody really knows anything about. And it goes on and on like this, really. And Victoria is such an icon. She had such a long reign. And also her reign was so utterly, utterly important for the formation of modern Britain. So much of what we've got today happened during her reign, and it happened despite her, not because of her in a lot of cases, or she had nothing to do with whatever the change was, but she was there, she presided over it. And I think as well that our love of her and our fascination with her comes from the fact that she's one of the first people that children study in school. I think every school child has been forced to endure school lessons on industrialisation. I did the Victorians in inverted commas when I was about 11 and loathed every second of it. Loathed the Victorians, hated the whole era. And it wasn't till I came back as a much more mature person and also as a sort of fully trained historian that I realised actually that era is almost infinite in its possibilities. And it is a fascinating and wonderful period to study from the social perspective and not necessarily from the which cog went where and which machine came in which year, which is the stuff you learn at school.
Oh, don't. Yes, memories of O-level history flashing before me now. Well, we're going to give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're going to listen to your first choice of music now, which is Le Court Bouillon, is that how you pronounce it, by Les Haricots Rouges. Why this one?
I lived in France for 3 years when I was a teenager. I did my A-levels in France. My father worked for Nestlé, and he was moved over there. And we spent 2 years just doing as much as possible. So we were conscious we were not there for very long. We wanted to maximise what we got out of living in a different country. So I became fluent in French. I lived with a French family and we did something every weekend. And one of the things we did was to go to this jazz concert. French companies tend to have a sort of scheme whereby you get subsidised tickets for things like that. And we went off to this thing and it was brilliant. And I liked jazz anyway. But when we went to this gig, and it was one of my first proper live gigs, and there was the banjo player at one point just ran across the stage naked and he was singing I'm Just a Gigolo, standing on a chair, wiggling himself in front of me. It was absolutely fantastic. As I bought the CD, which of course people say you should never do at gigs because you're in the atmosphere and it's never as good. And it was as good. And it was so good. And the words were so clever that when I was at university and I needed to cook fish in Corbillon, I played this song, which is a recipe, and I wrote down everything they said and I cooked the Corbillon from this particular track and it was perfect. So not only is it a good song, it's also a good recipe. Mettez beaucoup de piment et si l'écume déborde, épongez tout bonnement. Wow, que c'est bon, un bon Corbillon.
Great fun. That's Le Corbillon by Les Haricots Rouges, the first choice of music today from our studio guest on Bookmark, Annie Gray. Annie is an historian, cook, broadcaster and writer specialising in the history of food and dining in Britain from around 1600 to the present day. She's worked at Audley End, among other historical kitchens, and gives lectures all over the country. She's presented history documentaries, including the BBC's Victorian Bakers, and regularly appears on BBC Radio 4's The Kitchen Cabinet. The Greedy Queen, Eating with Victoria, is her first book. Food writer Nigel Slater said, "It had me at the first sentence," and historian Lucy Worsley described it as zingy, fresh and unexpected, a book to devour. Well, Annie, I suppose the first obvious question to ask is, why did you write this book?
It was two factors, really. One is that I wanted to explore Victorian cooking, Victorian cuisine, which I think has had a very, very bad press. A lot of people think Victorian cookery was stodgy, that it was suet-led, that it was heavy. They tend to think about Mrs. Beaton first and then really nothing after that. And the second thing was that I was very interested in the character of Victoria herself. I didn't set out to write a biography of Victoria, although it is a biography of Victoria, it is a culinary biography. I set out to explore Victoria and her world through food. But the thing with writing about food, especially historic food, is that if you're not very, very careful, it turns into a list of ingredients or recipes or things that people did, or just sort of unrelenting poverty, really. And in order to explore food and to really get it out there and to get it across to people in a way that's engaging, that's interesting, you really need to make it about people. And time and time again throughout a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last 5 to 10 years, I came back to Victoria as a person in lots of different aspects, lots of different ways. So when it came to thinking about writing a book about Victorian food, I already knew quite a bit about her and was interested in her. And she quite clearly ate a lot of food, judging by her weight and size at the end of her reign. So she seemed like a natural figure to look at food through. So really those two things came together in the form of a culinary biography, which is, I think, sort of what it really is. It's very much a look at Victoria through her food and doesn't deal with politics or motherhood or any of the other aspects that most conventional biographies would deal with.
And you make it very clear that this, you don't want this to be a book about a woman and her weight. You don't want to project current values and attitudes onto a different age.
No, I think that's a really dangerous thing to do. I start with this anecdote about a pair of bloomers that were sold several years ago for a phenomenal amount of money. And I've been taking part, convening really, one of the conveners in a historic Royal Palace's food course. And the bloomers featured on this course. And the reactions from the learners ranged from fascination to being absolutely appalled that people could fat shame this woman. And I thought, I don't want the book to be about fat shaming. I don't want the book to be about a woman who struggled with her weight, because these are all things we do today. There's no evidence whatsoever, really, that Victoria cared most of the time about her weight. It certainly didn't appear to affect her health. And our current preoccupation with weight is not always healthy when there are many, many other factors in terms of why someone is healthy or not. So what I wanted to do was to explore her food. And obviously through that, you do look at the impact of her food on her body and really on the other people around her as well. But emphatically, I was very, very careful not to say, oh, this is disgusting, she shouldn't eat like this, or she ate too much sugar as well. I mean, one of the other things that's come through very clearly in discussing this book with people is the current kind of obsessions in the media. 10 years ago, we should have eaten no fat. Fat was terrible. We should all eat fat-free everything. You know, now butter is good for us. Lard is even better. Sugar is demonised, and we should all give up all forms of sugar. We have a very schizophrenic relationship with food in the modern world, and it's very black and white, all or nothing. And that is not true of the past, and it's not a healthy attitude towards food either. So I did not want to make value judgments based on 2017's attitudes towards food, when in 2019 they'll be different.
Having said that, a lot of her preoccupations are ones that a modern woman can identify with: the comfort eating, the desire to lose weight after childbirth, the dieting.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's very, very human. And right from her adolescence, there's factors and ways she approaches the world which are very, very modern in some ways. When she's in her sort of mid-teens, she gets a bit obsessed with what other people look like and constantly wants to lose weight but doesn't do anything about it. And then she's ill and loses loads of weight and is really happy and sketches herself. And it's the sketch that she's done, which is sort of looking up at the viewer's viewpoint, I suppose, and with her hair sort of dangling around her face. If you put an Instagram filter on that, it is 100% modern 16-year-old going, look something at me and pouting.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And as she goes through life, she gains weight, she loses weight, she yo-yo diets. Lord Melbourne at one point tells her she's grown enormously fat, so she loses weight. She's 7'2" when she gets married, so her BMI is 18.8, so she's quite low on the BMI scale. Then she balloons after Albert dies. And, you know, in her letters, she often says, oh, I think I've been really fat and I need to lose some weight, and then doesn't bother to do anything about it. And those things, I think, are things that nearly all of us can empathise with, but there is a difference between empathising with something and then postulating reasons for it which are based in the modern world and not the Victorian world.
Well, let's put it on the table then, so to speak. A typical day for Victoria, I guess it's very hard that she probably didn't have many typical days, but what kind of thing would she eat in a typical day?
It depended very much whether she was at Buckingham Palace or Windsor or Osborne and Balmoral. So Osborne and Balmoral were the holiday homes, and there they lived a much more, in quotes, middle class lifestyle. But if she was at Windsor, say, as a formal, so she's married to Albert, she's having a formal day, she would rise early-ish, sort of 7:30, 8 o'clock-ish, do a little bit of work, then have breakfast, which is normally something like beefsteaks, mutton chops, omelette, maybe some fish, maybe some porridge after they discovered porridge in Scotland as well. They wouldn't necessarily eat all of it. There'd normally be two or three of them at breakfast, maybe up to five. A couple of ladies in waiting might join them. And then her main ladies in waiting and the gentlemen as well would eat separately in a separate room. Then she would attend to duties. I think the sort of idea of the Queen having duties is quite nebulous, but at that point, and still I think, the Queen has to sign into law everything. But in Victoria's case, she would genuinely sit down, read it all, and dispute it and debate it with her ministers, and she was much, much more involved in the day-to-day running of government. She and Albert also wrote a lot of letters, so there was a lot of kind of underground politics that went on, because of course they were related to most of the royal families of Europe. So while official negotiations and treaty making might well be going on at the government level, they'd be penning letters going, could you just sort this out, please? And by the way, can you send me some grapes? So there's a lot of that going on. There may well be a state visit, something like that happening. So she might well go and have a look at the kitchen gardens, check that everything's ready for that evening. They'll have lunch at about 1, 1.30. And that's a relatively informal affair most of the time. So it's normally just her and probably about 9 or 10 others. Although often she and Albert would sit down and they would have a sort of quite intimate little lunch. And that is served until really the 1870s as everything on the table at once. So it's a kind of buffet service. And they probably only got about 15 dishes in that to choose from. She might not have them all only. Then she'll go through the afternoon. She might well go out on a ride. She might go for a visit. If, as I say, she's at Windsor, there may well be dignitaries visiting. It's at that point, if she's at Osborne or Balmoral, where she might go on an excursion, go painting or sally off into the countryside somewhere. She normally had afternoon tea. And if it was at Balmoral or Osborne, she would find afternoon tea somewhere in a glen. Obviously, someone had turned up with a kettle beforehand. And she loved, absolutely loved afternoon tea. And then they would go through until the evening where the big dinner would be held. And even if it's a little big dinner, there's still usually a lot of food there. So up to the 1870s, it's served banqueting style, two courses, two or three courses. anything between 5 and 100 dishes on the table at once, depending on how big the dinner is. And then after the 1870s, it served sequentially, and then you'd have about 7 or 8 courses served one after the other. And the dinners could take anything from an hour to 3 hours, depending on how slowly or fast you ate.
Goodness, that is a lot of food. And the quality of that food, was it rich food, creamy food?
It was everything. With that much on the table, you really do have a choice of everything. The food was excellent. Nearly everybody who visited Buckingham Palace or Windsor commented on the excellence of the food. And it, as you would imagine, at a state banquet, there are certain favourites. So turtle soup crops up a lot. Very, very rich. But that's normally balanced by a slightly rich, less rich soup. Fried fish, fried smelts, fried whitings, very, very popular. Salmon, very, very popular as well. Turbot with a creamy sauce, cooked in a turbot kettle, so a specialist vessel. Costs a phenomenal amount to buy. Shows that you are of the ilk to be buying a turbot. Then you'd go on to what were known in the day as entrees. So they could be anything from a pie to some cutlets in a sauce to fricassees to ragouts to most of the meals that she had were named in French because French was the language of cuisine. And you go through and on, there'd always be a roast, for example, normally game. There'd always then be some farmed meats that's usually poached or boiled, again with a sauce. You'd have vegetables of various kinds, again often served in sauces being the mark of French cuisine. And then your sweet courses would be anything from fruit tarts, she loved fruit, through to very rich blancmanges, champagne jellies. Then you'd have your dessert, which was ice creams and water ices and fruit from the gardens. And there'd always be a sideboard as well with a cold fowl and piles of cold meat, tongue, that kind of thing on it, just in case you got hungry.
Goodness.
So there was a fair amount on offer, and there really was anything for absolutely everyone. When I was trying to look to see if she had any pregnancy cravings by looking at the ledger entries, the menus for when she was pregnant, and you couldn't identify anything because, quite frankly, she could have chosen from so many dishes that almost whatever she was craving
would
probably
be on
the table anyway. Yeah.
Well, yes, you mentioned pregnancy there. She was eating some of this while she was pregnant and wearing a corset.
Yes, and continued to drink as well. There was no idea that you wouldn't drink alcohol when you were pregnant at that point, and certainly you wouldn't give up cheeses or shellfish or any of that stuff. You just keep on eating it. So, yes, she had... there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that she may, and this is certainly something that a lot of women did, have different corsets for the different stages of pregnancy. And a corset, if you've got a well-fitted corset, and obviously hers would have been well-fitted, they're very, very comfortable and they're very supportive on the back. And of course, you've got huge skirts at that point. The crinoline is in the 1850s. The bustle is in a bit later on. There's a lot of heaviness, a lot of weight in your gowns. And the corset really helps to support all of that and take off the weight so it's not digging into you. So corsets are quite practical from that point of view. But obviously, you need to expand the laces as your pregnancy grows on. But even in quite late pregnancy, women usually wore some form of support, both to shape them and also to support their
backs.
But
eating that much with a corset, just that alone. We've all had moments where we've loosened our trousers after a meal.
Yeah, but I have put away 7 courses while wearing a corset, and I have to say, it is possible.
It is.
Small portions,
respect.
Pacing, and when you take the corset off, you almost feel a clunk as the food kind of goes down. But, you know, in the name of research, I have eaten that much in a fairly tight corset.
We can only admire. Thank you, Annie. Well, we'll come back and we'll talk more about Victoria's diet in just a moment. We're going to take a slight sidestep now. Anne-Marie Young has written fiction and non-fiction for children. Her latest book, Who Are Refugees and Migrants? What Makes People Leave Their Homes and Other Big Questions, was co-written with former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen. It followed on from their previous book together, What Is Humanism? When I met Anne-Marie, she updated me on the latest development regarding that first book.
The British Humanist Association had a fundraising campaign and raised enough money for a special edition of the Humanism book to be produced. This has been launched only a couple of weeks ago, and the book is being sent out free to all the primary schools in the country that teach Key Stage 2, that is, upper primary. The reason for the initiative is that the proportion of the population who identifies non-religious is actually really high, more than 50%. And so there are millions of people across the world and in this country whose philosophy of life and ethics and so on are not based on religious belief. And they may not call themselves humanists, but their underlying ethical principles are the same as those for humanists. And while schools rightly spend a lot of time exploring the ideas of the world's great religions, the ideas and the philosophy behind humanism are mostly ignored. So we believe that schools should, and the Humanist Association obviously believes that schools should reflect wider society, which is why they've had this campaign and this initiative. And we're really happy that it's taken off very well. We've had lots of extremely good feedback.
And actually, it's turned out to be the first book in a series that's questions,
yes,
asked questions about big issues, because now you've got this book out about refugees and migrants. Was that always the idea, that it would be part of a series?
No, we didn't realise that. In fact, I think the publishers themselves had the idea of turning it into a series when they saw how well the format of What is Humanism was received, because the whole point of that book and of the new book is that we question. We don't tell the readers what to think or how to think. And for example, with the Humanism book, we say to them, if at the end of this process you are still a believer, that's absolutely fine. But in fact, it will be your own idea. You won't just be accepting uncritically what other people have told you. The publishers thought that the whole format of asking big questions was a great idea, so they've turned it into a series. And we proposed the second book, or our second book in the series, which is called Who Are Refugees and Migrants? What Makes People Leave Their Homes? And Other Big Questions. When we proposed this, it was, what, 18 months ago? We did it quite quickly. It was then extremely relevant. It is still extremely relevant. And we're really pleased with the way this has turned out as well. And the whole point is to question the stereotypes, to look at the reality of people's lives. There is so much ignorance that is picked up on in the media, where people start to use words like, about 10, 15 years ago, the word asylum seeker was the dirty word. And now it's migrants, and it could be refugees, it could be migrants, whatever it is, people pick up on this and make them very negative, whereas we want to show the reality behind what is happening and who these people are.
And this is aimed at 10 to 14 year olds.
Yes.
So what's your starting point for that? How do you know where a 10, that's actually, it's only 4 years, but it's quite a big difference in awareness.
The books can be approached on different levels. There's quite a lot in the Refugees and Migrants books. It's quite solidly packed with information. But a 10-year-old could read the headings, the quotes from people, the contributions from people like Benjamin Zephaniah and Michael and myself, Mazun Al-Malehan, she was 17 then, amazingly inspirational Syrian asylum-seeking girl who came from Syria and is now campaigning for girls' education along with Malala Yousafzai. So a 10-year-old can read lots of what's in here and get a lot out of it. And there are other things that they might come back to.
And you mentioned personal experiences there, and you mentioned yourself and Michael because you've put your own experiences in the book.
We have. And in fact, one of the reasons that I have always felt so strongly about the issue is that my parents were not refugees, but they were migrants. And they were migrants to Australia from Egypt after the Second World War in 1949. And I grew up feeling very much very different from the Australians that I grew up with. And they were always asking me questions like, but what are you? Because it wasn't straightforward. My grandparents came from four different countries to Egypt. It was all a big melting pot, but that's how things were. We spoke French at home. We weren't French. My father was half Italian and half Scots, hence my surname, the boring surname, Young. My mother's father was Palestinian, and her mother was Russian. So, you know, when they said, but what are you? There was no simple answer. And the whole idea of identity and a personal identity, I struggled with when I was a younger child. But then, of course, it all became much more interesting as I got older. This has made me look at the whole issue of people on the move. It's true across history, across geography. People have always migrated, whether it's as refugees, whether it's as migrants. Our whole civilizations are based on that. There are very few where there hasn't been an awful lot of migration of one sort or another.
So you're covering history and
yes,
identity. What else is covered in the book?
We look at how they travel, what happens when they arrive, what rights they have. We also have a section called Does It Matter How We Use Words? Because of this whole issue of, you know, words becoming used as weapons almost against people. So we talk about that. We talk about what is culture and how we share it and what happens when we deliberately separate cultures and peoples, as in apartheid or in the States, the civil rights movement and what that was based on. And there is at the end, there is a sort of mini role play. We give children a situation where there's been a coup of some sort. Their city is under siege. Their parents, the father, for example, is a journalist who's been threatened by the new regime. Suddenly there are going to be tanks coming in. They need to flee. What will they do? This makes children think about what it must be like to be in a situation where your life is threatened, where your family's lives are threatened. What would it feel like? We end, if you like, with that. And then there's at the very end a section called What Do You Think? We ask them to write up their own declaration of human rights based on what they've read and, of course, based on some questions that we have in the book.
And what kind of reaction have you had from young people towards this so far?
Extremely positive, yeah. I mean, we've had loads of responses from teachers and parents. Very, very positive. I've shown it to three or four young people myself, and they just say, what does that mean? And, you know, I've never thought of that. They're just interested. They are really interested.
Well, looking at the book, I know it's aimed at 10 to 14-year-olds, but actually, I would say it's of incredible interest to everybody.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's one of the strengths as well of the way the series has been developed and of the format. We don't talk down, but neither is it so complex that 10-year-olds can't understand. Yeah, it's accessible. I think it's accessible to everyone. Getting interesting quotes from people. There's one at the beginning, which I would like to read out, if I might. It's a message that we want to get across. I got this through Dr. Mohammad Razai, a refugee from Afghanistan who is now a doctor and a medical researcher in the UK. He came to Hughes Hall, which is my college, so I'd heard about him and I got in touch with him. And he wrote, "Asylum seekers are human beings with the same feelings, ambitions and dreams as everyone else. People don't seek asylum unless they have to. Leaving home, family and friends and embarking on a journey to the unknown under difficult and dangerous conditions is not easy. I have heard people say asylum seekers are criminal parasites, and some even call them a threat to our future. But I hope people realise that asylum seekers want to be active, responsible and self-reliant members of society, and that demonisation is not helpful." He actually wrote that about 5 years ago, so before the current crisis, and he was speaking specifically about asylum seekers, so refugees. But the same thing applies. Migrants they don't have the same horrible journeys in the main, but the same thing applies.
That was Anne-Marie Young there speaking about her latest book, co-written with Michael Rosen, Who Are Refugees and Migrants, which is published by Wayland. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105, and my studio guest is Annie Gray. Anne-Marie there talking about really how to deliver a lot of information. You had a lot of information in your book about Queen Victoria, didn't you? I mean, you had to set it in the context of the Victorian age as well as focus in on her. How did you decide to structure it?
I'm very used to lecturing, which is, I think, one of the strengths that I had when I sat down to write this book. So a lot of what I do is to give hour-long lectures to people where, and very mixed audiences as well, where I am effectively precising a vast amount of information very, very quickly. And I also used to work in costume a great deal, both at Audley End and also at Hampton Court and places like that, where... excuse me, where again you are putting across a lot of information, often to people who have no knowledge whatsoever of British history, and you're doing it in a way to engage people. I think one of the fundamental things with writing a book like this, which is very much popular history, it could easily be used by an academic, by somebody wishing to really get to grips, the information in there, the referencing and the footnotes all in there, but I want to reach a popular audience, people who say, and I had a lady last night say to me, "I'm not really very interested in history, I hated it at school, but I heard you on the radio with you and I thought I'd buy your book and see what it's like. So I've bought it and I thought that's exactly the person I want to read this book. So through years and years of working with the public and working with people who are not always native English speakers, working with people with no knowledge of history whatsoever, one of the things I've learned is how you engage people. And one of the biggest things I think with writing something like this is you have to have people reading it in order to then be able to tell them anything. There's absolutely no point in writing a brilliant book stuffed full of facts if it's so tedious no one wants to read it. And as an academic, when I was doing my PhD, if I found books like that, you know, I would put them aside. I think there's no point. I'm absolutely, you know, I'm convinced that plain English writing, good writing, is so fundamental. So I structured this really as I would a lecture. I set out to do something which was essentially chronological. It is a biography, it does look at her life, but also thematic within that. So childhood is a chapter. Obviously, that's quite contained, the same with the old age chapter at the other end of the book. But through the book, although it does move slowly through time, it also jumps about a bit. So there is... The first chapter after childhood is about dining style, which is something really fundamental that underlies the whole way in which Victoria ate. And I chart that throughout her reign, but the bulk of that chapter talks about her early years, and there's also lots of information about her attitudes towards food when she first became queen. I go on and I have a chapter on public palaces, so Windsor and Buckingham Castle, which is effectively about the kitchens, which were really scuzzy, really unbelievably horrible. And then I go on to talk about private palaces, and that's really about her and Albert getting together. There's a chapter on motherhood, which is very much about all the children, but also about that middle phase of Victoria's life, and so on and so forth. So there are sort of breakout chapters on kitchens and cooks, but even they are within the chronology. So it sort of came out quite naturally in terms of how it would write itself, almost because of the fact that this is how I would structure a lecture and this is what I would do if I was speaking. And again, with the voice that I've used, the narrative voice, I've tried to keep it quite like the voice that I would use when speaking, because a lot of people who read it will come to it through listening to me on The Kitchen Cabinet or seeing me on TV or one of my lectures. I mean, obviously not everybody, but I think if you've got a voice that people are used to hearing, and in my case, it is a mixture of authority and lightheartedness with the occasional knob gag thrown in, let's face it, then to then be a completely different person when you're writing, it doesn't do you any good. So I've tried to keep it as if I'm talking to someone, as if I'm there and we're having a conversation, which I really enjoyed, actually. It was a very nice writing style. It was a complete opposite to writing my PhD thesis, which, of course, had to fit all the academic norms, and where my tutor actually told me I needed to clunk it up in order to make it sound more academic so that it would get a higher grade.
Oh, it's a very enjoyable read. It is a very enjoyable read. Well, and it's a very enjoyable piece of music that you've chosen here as well. This is your second choice, Coming Back as a Man by Caro Emerald. Why this one?
I love Caro Emerald. We went to go and see her recently. She's a fabulous performer. And I just really like the words to this one. I think it speaks to all of us, especially us historians, who have struggled for so long with history being about great white men trampling over the world. And this is a gender-based song. And, you know, I've written a book which is unashamedly about a woman, and where I have one of the big things in writing the book was to try and pull out women's stories and the stories of the lower classes who are not always talked about in conventional biographies. So to me, this one sort of talks about the struggle a bit.
I see your leaders incomplete their lies. That's why I sigh. It's not just me I talk about. Our rage is on the way. All the money in the women's world will never make them change. Gonna grab the...
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark, and my guest on Bookmark today is Annie Gray, talking about her book, The Greedy Queen, Eating with Victoria. Annie, what struck me reading the book, actually, I was surprised. In a way, the diet was more varied, not only more varied than I expected it to be, actually more varied than our diet now, particularly in relation to things like fruit and vegetables. There were fruit and vegetables there I'd never even heard of.
Yeah, our modern diet is really, really unvaried, especially in the way of fruit and vegetables. I mean, largely in the past, not so much in the Victorian period, but slightly before, if it moved, if it crawled, if it swam, if it flew, if it grew, we would eat it. Partly because you would eat anything, especially if you were poor, but also because we just didn't have the level of squeamishness that we've got now. And also we were not led by big chain supermarkets and their need to be able to transport things. So a lot of the fruit and veg that we're eating, things like medlars or quinces, they were bruised so easily that a supermarket today would struggle to stock them and keep them in good condition. Other things, such as the level of offal that was eaten, we are much more squeamish than we used to be. We are richer than we used to be. It takes a very wealthy nation to be able to make the food choices that we make today in general, and to be able to reject parts of animals or fruit and veg that don't please us just because we don't like them. I mean, the Victorians were... The variety was incredible. Fruit and veg is one of those things I constantly kind of talk about because we've just lost so much. If you go into the average shop today, you might find, what, 5 varieties of apples. You'll get a Bramley, you'll get a Golden Delicious, or you'll get a Granny Smith, which is brilliant for salads, but not a lot else. You might get something hideous like a Pink Lady or a Fiji or a Royal Guard, something so sweet that it's unbelievably nasty to eat. And then you kind of peter out. I mean, you get British Coxes for a while and they're really good, but you know, that's it. And the Victorians had about 2,000 varieties of apples. Everything from Pitmaston pineapples to Norfolk Biffins to Ashmead's kernels. I'm growing half of these in the garden because I just want to eat them. And they are fabulous, a lot of these things. And yes, some of them do require more work, either in growing or in preparing, than things we use today. But by and large, they're worth the effort. And yeah, we've lost a lot.
Well, respect to you, because at the end of the book, you actually make some of the recipes, don't you? You follow some of the recipes that were on the table in Queen Victoria's Day, including boar's head in aspic jelly.
Yes. My best friend and I cooked the boar's head, and we've done it 3 times now. We did it for a laugh, basically. I wanted to cook this thing, so she came over, and in my extraordinarily small, at the time, kitchen in Ely, we stuffed and prepared a boar's head, and then her family came over and ate it. And we had so much fun doing it, it takes 2 weeks, that we decided to do it for an event for Audley End. We did an Everything But the Squeak Week event, and unfortunately it was one of the coldest winters around and it snowed and the event was snowed off halfway through us having prepared this thing. So we thought, right, okay, we're going to do it again. And we finally did it properly for a Christmas event at Audley End, where it was a sort of 3-week long event. And on the first week, we skinned this boar's head. It doesn't even start with that. It starts with having to know your local butcher. And
it's also getting a boar's head, yeah.
Well, you can't get boar's heads in England, and you couldn't in the Victorian period. Victoria could. She had them imported from Germany. But for most people, you used a pig's head. So my best friend's dad used to farm pigs. We would go up. We would find a pig that looked like a boar, put a cross on its back. Then it would go along to the butcher's, who had his own abattoir. So he would slaughter it and cut it off at the second vertebrae. You need to have it cut quite a long way back rather than just behind the ears, which you'd get if you bought an off-the-peg pig's head today. Anyway, so then we would skin this thing, and we did that 1 week. You then brine it for 2 weeks, and you turn it every day, and the salt and the saltpeter and the herbs and the spices, and it requires a separate fridge, obviously, to keep it in for 2 weeks. And then at the end of those 2 weeks, you stuff it, which takes a full day because you have to sew the thing together using a gloving needle and a thimble. And so you sew the jaw shut, and you sew the eyelids shut, and otherwise you push the sausage meat and it sort of cries sausage meat. And this goes on for ages, and you flip the skin over and you swaddle it in butter muslin and you boil it for 5 hours, and the next day you get it out and it honestly looks like a hemorrhoid. It's just appalling. And we did this at Audley, and we stripped off the butter muslin and it looked horrid. And this little child went, ugh, I wouldn't eat that. I thought, oh my goodness, this is like, you know, this is the main point of this day. So then you literally pimp your boar's head. You sit down and you pipe lard on it, and you cut out bits of ham, and you do all sorts of bits and bobs to it. Brush it with jelly and put jelly around the outside of it. And we finished this thing after 5 hours of the two of us working on this thing in a really crowded kitchen. Lots and lots of people came through that day. And I looked up at the end just as we finished, and this little boy had come back and was now on top of his father's shoulders because the kitchen was so crowded. And he said, whoa! And I thought, it's the same boy. This is a brilliant opportunity. So I said, this young lad was in at the beginning of the day. And he said, what did you say, young man? He said, I said, I wouldn't eat it. It's disgusting. I said, and would you eat it now? He said, yeah. I said, ladies and gentlemen, we eat with our eyes.
You have a convert. We'll hold that thought of the boar's head. in our head. We're still in the realm of children. There, a slight sidestep here. We're going to hear more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. The theme was location as inspiration, with entrants invited to write a piece of prose or poetry about a place in Cambridge. We'll hear now three of these entries. The Round Church by Oliver Lee, read by Andrew Shepherd, was a winner in the 7 to 11-year-old category. Cat on the Hat by Rebecca Clay, read by Helen Holgate, was a runner-up in the same category. But we'll start with The Traveller by Leonia DePledge, read by Flaviana Cruz, which was a winner in the 12 to 16-year-old category.
A brown, patched-up suitcase, held by a limp, trembling hand. A face set, scared but determined, setting foot in an unknown land. He steps off the train into noise, many people with a mission ahead. None have time for a refugee boy, with no friends, no food and no bed. As he steps out into the open, a cold, sharp wind rushes to greet him. It wreathes around his young, tired face. Only his scarf keeps the heat in. He looks around for anyone he knows. Did his family escape alongside? But no, he's alone in this terrifying world. Nowhere to go, to run or to hide. Along the pavement he goes, his steps unsteady and unsure. Cambridge to him is a paradise after being trapped in months of war. Elongated shards of fractured light beams across the hard, cold ground. Cyclists swarm past, so many of them, dominating the famous town. As he walks to the end of Station Road, he sees a statue bathed in sun, a majestic soldier looking back for friends that might never come. The bronze figure's gaze seems to rest on him for only a moment, maybe more. Yet it gives him courage, welcomes him. His wounds don't feel quite so sore. As he carries on down the street, bright red buses pass left and right, double-decker, shiny and new, a world apart from his usual sight. The colour shops and cafes boast a variety of things, clothes, food, ornaments, phones, or even diamond rings. The Grand Arcade, what riches, a place within its walls. Back home, stuff like this was stolen by those that to him were cruel. After trekking through street after street, he reaches the famous River Cam. He sees families getting into long wooden boats and making their way downstream. Something about the pole-driven boats reminds him of when he was small. Ah, yes. He used to play in something like this in the evenings after school. As he approached the riverside slowly, he sees something that makes him stop. An upturned, discarded boat, lying in weeds and starting to rot. He looks about suspiciously to check that no one is around. Then he pushes hard against the boat till it's lying face up on the ground. Then he pushes it into the river and, wobbling, jumps inside. He grabs the long wooden pole, manoeuvring his boat behind bushes to hide. He secretly watches other boats sail past, noticing how they move. He observes carefully until he's sure that he could do it too. Then he emerges into the water, clutching the pole and standing up. He imitates the moves other punters made, thrusting the pole down into the muck. The boat begins to move along, but the pole stuck stays behind. Desperate, the boy tries to pull it free, leaning back with all his might. Suddenly, he stumbles, falling into the water limb after limb. In a moment of terror, he remembers that he never learned to swim. He scrambles at the punt, recalling the little English he knows. Help! He cries desperately. Help! Spurting water out through his nose. A family passing by hears his cries and stop. In a moment of decision, the dad jumps in. A coward is one thing he's not. He swims over to the refugee boy, grabbing him around the waist. Then he turns over to his back. Make haste, his wife calls. Make haste! Soon he reaches the shore. The man's wife pulls him onto the bank. In gratitude, he hugs them. To think he nearly sank. Are you okay? Where is your family? You shouldn't be alone, the man says. The boy looks at him, and with a trembling voice he whispers, "Family? Dead?" "I'm so sorry," the wife steps forward, taking him into her arms. "We'll look after you for the minute. With us, you'll come to no harm." "Where did you come from?" the man inquires, staring at the suitcase in the punt. "Syria," the boy explains. "Refugee, alone, must run. We'll take you to a reception center. They'll find you a home, care for you." One of the daughters looks up at him. "And we'll visit you often too." The boy doesn't quite understand, but he realizes the intent. He nods, processing the words. He's happy and content. "Thank you," the boy smiles. His widest grin shows what he cannot say. "I've found a new family. I'm so grateful to you. Now I know that I will be okay."
Cambridge 105.
Listen to us on Radio Player at Cambridge105.fm.
Morning. Mossy stone and wet floor, coned roof and wood door, green grass and crisp breeze, beautiful flowers and colourful trees, birds tweeting and priests talking, morning dew and people walking. Night. Cricket sounding and moonlight, dry roof and tranquil night, leaves rustling and rabbits reeling, birds tweeting and priests kneeling.
Cambridge 105.
Hello, my name is Snowy Farr. I'm a white cat, and day by day I sit on a hat which is placed on four enlarged and weirdly modelled jelly beans. But the best part of all is the mice, who run, without moving, around my black and white hat. The sound of chatter and admiration embraces the air. The buzz-filled crowds scamper for the goods. Children playing too far from their mothers and me. Me standing. Me just standing. A still statue. King of the market, they call me. I watch and watch as people enjoy their shopping days. In the winter, as I endure the bitter cold, I look around and see the light sparkle in the night sky. My ears melt as I hear the joyful spirit spread all around, and my eyes exchange looks with the smiling faces taking an evening stroll. However, my favourite times of the year is when the doors are open and the summer breeze brushes through my fur. The sun shines and shines as shoppers wander through my domain and stop and look at the striking and unusual view that they behold. Unfortunately, humans aren't like me. They can see something wrong with everything, something they don't like. After all, nothing is perfect, but the humans make that very clear. When it's a beautiful winter, they complain of the cold, but in the warm summer, they complain about the heat. Humans are such complainers. I suppose they can't help it. It's in their blood. So good day to you all, and goodbye. Do come visit me.
That was Cat on the Hat by Rebecca Clay, read by Helen Holgate. Before that, we heard Round Church by Oliver Lee, read by Andrew Shepherd. And before that, The Traveller by Leonia DePledge, read by Flaviana Cruz. Well, we're coming to the end of our time with you, Annie Gray, unfortunately. We've been talking about The Greedy Queen, which is published by Profile Books. The question we ask all our guests is, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, goodness, I have a huge reading pile, and I'm about halfway through about three different books. I'm reading a biography of Rosa Lewis, who was a society chef in the Edwardian period. It's written in the 1970s, and it's a slightly odd style, it must be said. I'm reading a book about Capability Brown, because I adore Georgian landscapes. I've also got, I think, a crime novel on the go. All sort of different. I can't take the Capability Brown book out of the house. It's too large. Rosa can go out the house, but I also have a book I've started on Kindle, because while I'm not a big fan of Kindles, I much prefer real books. Needs must, and we have far too many books in our house, so I do have a Kindle for fiction. So I must have started the crime novel at some point, and to be honest with you, I can't even remember the title of it. Clearly it's gripping me. But I tend to read sort of anything and everything, really, so I do normally have quite a lot on the go.
And what are you writing?
I'm writing the official Downton Abbey cookbook at the moment.
Oh, what a beautiful job.
Which is quite fun. And then I'm just pitching for a second book, a follow-up to Victoria, which hopefully will be about a society chef in the 1920s and 30s.
Lovely. Well, we'll hear your last rather wonderful choice of music in just a moment. And our next show, debut novelist Megan Hunter will be here talking about her novel, The End We Start From, which is already getting rave reviews. We'll also hear from Sarah Turner, blogger and writer, a.k.a. The Unmumsy Mum. She'll be talking about her latest bestseller, The Unmumsy Mum Diary, plus more winning entries from the Rock Road Library Creative Writing Competition. Podcasts of all our old shows are on the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. And I should say, we've been talking about food today. We have a food programme here on Cambridge 105 too, which is Flavour, which runs every other Saturday, and podcasts of that show are also on the Cambridge 105 website. But we're going to sign out now with this rather marvellous track, which is Conchita Wurst, Rise Like a Phoenix. Why this one?
I love Eurovision. I mean, I think anyone who doesn't love Eurovision has something dead in their soul. It's a celebration of music, it's a celebration of Europe. It's satisfyingly bonkers. And for me, it's a lovely, lovely occasion to sit down with friends and listen to music which ranges from the brilliant to the appalling. And I think this is one of the best winners of the last few years. And it's one of those songs that I like to put on in the car very, very loudly and sing along to. And then I'll repeat the whole thing two or three times, because it's only me in the car. Me on the A1 in my car in this. That's sort of, I don't know, it's one of those little pleasures in life.
Thank you, Annie. Lovely talking to you.
From the fading light.